Hello, and welcome to Stepping Into Truth, the podcast where we have conversations on race, gender, and social justice. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I'm very glad that you're here with me today. Hosting this podcast means that I am privileged to speak with people who are out in the world making a difference with their day jobs, their programs, their art, and their activism. And I love doing this. If you would like to support me in this work, you can do so for as little as $3 a month by becoming a member of my Patreon community. You can go to patreon.com/OmkariWilliams and sign up. And there's also a link on my website, OmkariWilliams.com. My guest today, Alex Zamalin, is director of the African American Studies Program and assistant professor of political science at the University of Detroit Mercy. His areas of expertise include African American political thought, American politics, and political theory. He's the author of numerous books, including African American Political Thought and American Culture, The Nation's Struggle for Racial Justice. Also, Anti-Racism, An Introduction. His work has been featured in ESPN's Undefeated, The Guardian, and Yes Magazine. His newest book is titled Against Civility, The Hidden Racism in Our Obsession with Civility, from Beacon Press. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Alex to the program. Hi, Alex. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Oh, I'm really excited about this. Your book came at just the perfect moment for me because this is a conversation I've been having with people a lot lately about civility and what that means and the implications. So when I saw the title of your latest book, I was really intrigued. I looked at it and I thought, Against Civility, The Hidden Racism and Our Obsession with Civility. I was like, this is for me. This is perfect. So let's just sort of lay it out like this. We live in a society that really prizes itself on being civil as though that is somehow the highest virtue. And I would like to start by talking about how civility gets turned against those with legitimate complaints, and it's used to actually redirect the conversation away from actual change.
Thank you. So maybe one of the ways that we can be in the conversation is for me to talk a little bit about how I came to this project. One of the things that was really striking to me as someone who's been teaching and studying American history, and in particular African American history, is that when I imagined the roots of civility, the origins of the term, initially I had thought that it was a tool used by moderates, liberals, progressives who were looking to change the world for the better. But the thing that became quite clear to me as I started to do the reading and look at the history was the exact opposite, that civility from the outset was used for a very specific purpose and reason. It was wielded by white supremacists, slaveholders, racists, defenders of injustice in order to silence, police, and delegitimize legitimate grievances from anti-racists. So the real starting point for the book was a speech given by the defender of the slaveholding class, John C. Calhoun. He's a vice president under Andrew Jackson and a senator from South Carolina. And Calhoun gets on the Senate floor in 1837 and gives this speech where he says the greatest threat to the Union is not slavery, which is keeping 3 million people in bondage at the time, but instead it's the rising tide of uncivil abolitionism that is coming from New England, led by William Lloyd Garrison, led by, at that point, a young Frederick Douglass. This is the real problem in society, and that the real thing that is tearing this nation apart is the uncivil, unwieldy, critical dissent that is coming from anti-racists. So when I saw this and noticed that, I wondered, was this an anomaly or a pattern? And it became striking to me that this was the pattern, that when I looked through the 19th century and the 20th century, time and time again, it's not liberals, it's not progressives, it's not anti-racists who are calling for civility. It is actually those who want to keep an unjust system in place. I'll give you another brief example, which is quite striking to me. In 1898, there is a terrible, I mean, it's a horrifying racial massacre in Wilmington, North Carolina. This mob of white vigilantes, 2,000, marches into the Black section of Wilmington, which has a thriving newspaper, thriving Black business scene, and it essentially destroys the town. Now, what's notable is not simply that this is a pattern that is happening at the end of the 19th century in conjunction with lynching and all other forms of racial violence. What's notable is that both the governor of North Carolina and the mayor of Wilmington say that this violent act was not only an anomaly, but it was necessary. It was necessary for the sake of preserving civility. So when I saw the way that violence was being used over and over again in order to silence dissent, but more importantly, for the purpose of pursuing a white supremacist agenda in the name of civility, it became clear to me that it wasn't simply that civility was ineffective, but that it was a dangerous tool and weapon that was consistently being mobilized by the right and reactionary forces.
That is fascinating. And as you were speaking, I thought about the way people will do what we now call tone policing, which is essentially the same thing. It's like, oh, I don't like your tone, so we're not going to have this conversation, which redirects the energy away from whatever it was that was the seed of the conversation into, I don't like your tone, so we're not going to speak. And it seems like that is the same thing on a smaller level, a more interpersonal level, rather than a broader governmental political level.
Right.
And, you know, it's always so frustrating when I either have people try and tone police me, which never works out very well, or witness it. I'm just like, what are you doing? You're missing the point. Or maybe they're not. Maybe they're not missing the point. Maybe they're doing exactly what they want to do. So something to think about. So in your book, you use a term a great deal, and that term is civic radical. And I would like you to define that for us and give us some examples of people who embody that, because I am now going to be using that term all the time.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I think naturally, as someone who studies history and thinks about politics from a historical perspective, I was genuinely curious, what is the most successful anti-racist strategy available, not simply for combating civility, but for achieving justice? And so I tried to find examples of anti-racists using civility. And it was clear that there are few and far between. Even the anti-racists that at the beginning of their careers try to build the politics of reaching across the aisle. Think of Frederick Douglass in the 1840s. Think of Martin Luther King in the 1950s. Eventually, they move away. They move away because they recognize that civility is a losing position. And I wanted to be clear in this book that there is a different strategy outside of civility that does not require violence. This is one of the really important misconceptions that I think I was trying to tackle, which is, given that the conversation is tone policed and controlled around the idea of, are you civil or uncivil, it becomes hard for anyone to step outside the box and create a politics or create a certain level of voice, speaking, engagement that is outside civility. So civic radicalism names the kind of engagement that is unapologetic, disruptive, collective, and focused on actually centering attention on unjust structures rather than unjust habits or personal feelings. So I'll give you some examples. I think at the end of the 19th century, one of the greatest civic radicals is Ida B. Wells, who's an important feminist, Black feminist anti-lynching activist. In 1884, as she is a young woman, she's on a train trying to get to a teaching position in rural Memphis. And a conductor, a racist conductor, this is 12 years before Jim Crow was formalized with Plessy v. Ferguson. A racist conductor tells her that she needs to sit in the back of the train, which is a smoke-filled cabin. And rather than going into the back, she refuses and has to be dragged out of the train. Now, this is 70 years before Rosa Parks. But what's so important about both Rosa Parks and Ida B. Wells is rather than simply saying this is unjust, both of these feminists use this as a stepping stool for conducting a collective struggle. So Ida B. Wells politicizes this event and says, we need to understand that this is not an isolated incident. And so we need to mobilize against this and against all kinds of violence, whether directed towards women, whether directed by lynch mobs towards Black citizens. All of this is connected. And so Ida Wells decides that she will, on the one hand, engage in direct activism on the streets. She sees her teaching as a political vocation as well. But at the same time, Ida Wells takes to the newspapers and she begins to write scathing editorials, so much so that by the early 1890s, her office is targeted and burned. Luckily, she's in New Jersey on a speaking tour, but she is targeted because she speaks out. Another example in the 1960s is someone like Martin Luther King. I think there's a temptation to read MLK as a civil figure because he uses nonviolence. But just because you use nonviolence as a strategy does not mean that you are buying the idea that civility is the best kind of political strategy. Because what King does in his 1963 letter from Birmingham jail is say the greatest threat to democracy, the greatest threat to the Black freedom struggle is not the Klansman. It's the white moderate who tries to assume that a neutral position or a civil position is the best position. And so what King does throughout the 1960s, boycott, strike, marches. On the day of his death, when he's assassinated, he is organizing sanitation workers in Memphis. He is constantly, as all civic radicals are, he's constantly broadening the anti-racist struggle away from simply focusing on race, but also on gender, class, on empire. And so King, in the late 1960s, is building a poor people's movement and saying what Black feminists in the 1970s are saying, that we need to think intersectionally about racial justice. And what King is doing, as all civic radicals are doing, is they're calling into question the rules by which society is organized. So rather than assume that you are either civil or uncivil, King continues to call into question the very way in which society is organized and how it distributes punishment, violence, economic opportunity, and so on.
Yeah, I love what you're saying there, because something I've become increasingly aware of just through my reading is how truly radical Dr. King was. And I agree 100%. People, I think, don't notice that because he did practice nonviolence and preached nonviolence. But those things are not mutually exclusive. And I think that we need to broaden our understanding of him if we're actually going to make the kind of progress that we need to make. So thank you for that. So another thing that struck me as I was reading your book, in line with that whole thing, is there's an enhanced perspective on historical individuals like Booker T. Washington and Frederick Douglass. And I was a history major, and in most history classes, they get kind of lumped together. But they actually took dramatically different approaches to racial justice. And I think it's important to understand those different approaches and understand that we really need to have a more truthful telling of the history of these men and other activists. So could you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is such an important difference. And it's so important to understand history from the perspective of how it was lived and enacted. And so when I think of figures like Douglass and Booker T. Washington, it's clear that although on some level they were both accepted as so-called spokespersons for the race, they were radically different in the way that they imagined politics and the way that they thought about engagement. You take the example of Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass is a fugitive ex-slave. He escapes bondage and builds his whole political career off knowing that bondage and racial domination are unimaginably cruel. And what Douglass does throughout his life is constantly ask the question, how can we prevent, stop white supremacy, which is hell-bent on reproducing bondage and racial violence in whatever way it can? How do we stop this kind of activity? So Douglass at first thinks that the best approach is to agree with William Lloyd Garrison, who suggests that persuading white people talking about moral conscience is the right strategy. But then as Douglass responds to changing conditions on the ground, he sees there's something that is happening. And in 1850, Congress decides to pass the Fugitive Slave Act. Once Douglass sees this, he recognizes that it's impossible to simply ask white supremacy to come to the table and negotiate, because white supremacy is expanding. The Fugitive Slave Act basically allows for slave catchers from the South to come up north and perpetuate bondage throughout the nation. So Douglass, in a speech, says resistance by any means necessary might be the only way to topple the system. So Douglass is a pragmatist who emphasizes direct action. Booker T. Washington, from the beginning of his career, believes that racial reconciliation is the most effective strategy. Booker T. Washington believes, and on some level, there's a pragmatism to Washington's thinking as well, because Washington's gambit is that the South is such a racist and corrupt space that there cannot be any kind of prospect for Black freedom that isn't already compromised. So the best thing Black citizens can do is try to work from within the system. So that's why someone like Booker T. Washington gives his Atlanta Compromise speech to say that the best approach is one where Black citizens are reaching across the aisle, reconciling, leaving their bucket where it is. And what's notable is that Douglass continues to agitate for racial justice. He continues to push folks like Abraham Lincoln, who believes in the project of colonization, whereas someone like Washington is perfectly okay to dine at Teddy Roosevelt's White House and to not say anything negative about the Spanish-American War as it is taking up American headlines. And so I think the two examples of Douglass and Washington show two different visions of political engagement and anti-racist struggle. Douglass is the one who focuses on direct action and engagement, and Washington thinks compromise, negotiation, and reconciliation is the best strategy.
We're at the 100-year anniversary of the Tulsa massacre. And in your book, one of the things you say is that the Tulsa massacre laid bare the irony behind Booker T. Washington's call for civility. So say more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's so important to understand how civility works politically, because on one level, you can say civility is ineffective precisely because it's weaponized by white supremacists, or it's ineffective because you need something more disruptive. The Tulsa massacre shows that even when Black citizens respond to the call to be civil, even when they follow this doctrine of racial uplift, of building business, of assuming respectability, they're still criminalized, condemned, and treated in a way that allows for white supremacy to flourish. I think the same story is the one that I shared in Wilmington. You have a thriving Black community that basically, in practice, rejects all of the racism that has been used and mobilized by white supremacists. And still, white supremacy will come up with any kind of twisted, contorted justification to say that it's still not enough. That even if you're civil, you will still be subject to violence and punishment. You take the example of Martin Luther King. On some level, using the idea of nonviolence, wearing the best suit he could find, was still not enough for white supremacists because they get to control the conversation about who's civil and who's not. And that's one of the reasons, I think, that throughout history, Black activists and anti-racists turn away from civility, because even if they don't recognize it at the beginning, they eventually come to see that civility is a narrative around virtue, respectability, and what's normal. And the folks who get to control all of these discourses and conversations are those who have access to the most amount of violence, the most amount of power, and have a great willingness to use that violence and power and then justify it in the name of civility later on.
Something that you said in the book that ties into that as I'm listening to you is you talk about how white people become resentful when Black people do not shower them with gratitude for whatever it might be. And you say that this self-congratulatory aspect of white civility combines with the perceptions of Black incivility and that that fuels white grievance. And I found that really fascinating. I would like to hear more about that.
Yeah, I appreciate you being such a close reader of the book. It's really wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was fun. Yeah. Sort of fun.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, I think one of the things that really stood out to me was the 1960s. I was discussing the 1960s specifically in the context of the increasing Black militancy. So you take the Black feminists, the Black Panther Party in the 1960s, who are responding directly to conditions on the ground. They're responding to the fact that Democrats at the time are only willing to go so far. Lyndon Johnson is only willing to go so far as the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And yet many students and young people see that there's so much more to be done. The Black Panther Party is founded in Oakland in 1966 because there's an epidemic of police brutality. There are urban rebellions throughout the country because living conditions for Black citizens are not okay and racially unequal. So there's a push from the youth to say more needs to be done. But what's remarkable is rather than simply saying that the youth are misguided in their political position or this is untenable, they weaponize civility to denounce all of these young anti-racists. But more precisely, the argument that many white moderates are making at the time is that enough is enough, that Black citizens should be happy and grateful with being given the honor of having equal rights. But beyond equal rights, beyond any kind of redistributive practice, beyond any kind of voting rights, nothing can be done. And so many white moderates treat the militancy that is pushing for racial justice with contempt. And you see this, quite frankly, today, when many white people at the outset were okay with Black Lives Matter after the murder of George Floyd, precisely because they were trying to call, activists were trying to call attention to the epidemic of police brutality against unarmed Black men and women. But once the movement started to go into the direction of defund the police, end mass incarceration, let's talk about economic equality, that's when many white moderates soured. And they started to argue that on some level, we can tolerate a level of equality, but only tolerate that. Once there is anything that is going beyond that, there's going to be a resentment, anger. And I think it assumes this idea that somehow white people are the true figures of the nation. They are the true Americans. They're the real Americans. The American flag means whiteness. And so connected to this question of civility, I think there's a kind of cultural conception that equality for any marginalized group is okay insofar as the white majority thinks it's okay. And any claim for anything more than that is treated with resentment, anger, and contempt.
It feels very paternalistic, you know? It feels very much like what white moderates, what white conservatives are saying is, we will allow you these things. And I don't think they hear the irony in allowing human beings, allowing adults things. And I think it's part of the struggle. And the whole notion of civility is also very paternalistic. It's, you know, you are raised to be polite to your parents, but this is not the circumstance we find ourselves in. And so it's really challenging. You define revolution in a way that I found to be very interesting. You say it's not about reorganizing government to be more representative or the redistribution of private property, but as being about how we relate to one another. And I went back and forth over that paragraph a few times, and I would really like you to say more about that.
Sure. I think one of my great heroes and one of the great inspirations for the book was James Baldwin. And the one thing that I learned from James Baldwin, I had written about him in my first book, is that Baldwin believed that there was something inadequate about imagining revolution simply through the redistribution of wealth or political power, because there's a certain kind of cheap price to that. You can put a dollar amount, you can put a certain kind of value on it. What Baldwin was calling for was a fundamental reimagination of what it means to be part of a community, what it means to be free, what it means to be part of a democracy. And so when Baldwin writes about the importance for white people to do away with white innocence, to do away with a certain failure to acknowledge Black inequality and Black suffering, Baldwin is trying to argue that politics on some level requires a reorganization of various goods and resources, but it also requires a fundamental willingness to transform the self, to accept a certain level of vulnerability, to accept a certain level of insecurity, because that's what it means to be a human being. And part of what Baldwin is saying throughout his essays is that whiteness is based in a certain kind of fantasy of permanence, of fixed boundaries, of black and white. And that's why he often uses this kind of misleading idea, but he says, white people choose whiteness. And what he means by that is they choose to live in a condition of innocence, choose to live in a condition potentially of immaturity, rather than recognizing that life is dynamic. There needs to be a certain level of cooperation, hospitality, generosity, and more importantly, a willingness to be free. Because you cannot be free, according to Baldwin, if you hold on to race, if you hold on to certain kinds of conservative ideals, that the only way that you can actually become free is if you open yourself up to doing away with all of these ideas that you've held on to for so long. And at the same time, Baldwin is saying part of what that means is doing away with these stories of this is civil, this is not, this is okay, this is not. That's what it means to have a revolutionary mentality. It is to actually challenge the very assumption of what's normal, what's right, what's good, and do it in collaboration with other human beings who are living, thinking, breathing, and acting in the world.
I think the thing that struck me most listening just now is the notion of community, because I think that one of the problems that we confront right now is individualism. And certainly, I want individuals to change their behavior and change how they engage in the world. But individuals alone isn't going to get it done. I think that we need to have a broader understanding of that this is a communal problem, and also just a broader understanding of what community is. And I think that when you talk about civility, it creates lines, it creates boundaries that define community and put it into individual boxes. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think that part of the really important story of civic radicalism and anti-racism throughout American history is, to put it simply, individualism does not work. Individualism did not end slavery. Individualism did not end the epidemic of lynching. It did not end Jim Crow, and it will not end mass incarceration and police brutality. The story of civic radicalism is one of collective action. It's folks who come out in the street, who may not know one another, who may not even know what their commitments are, but by being there, being present with others, listening to others, understanding that there is value to be had in collective action, there's value to be had in an unapologetic commitment to liberation and freedom and justice, you become transformed and you recognize that there actually is power in numbers. And moreover, that individualism is simply not enough. And one of the things that I think is so important and lost is that there actually is a historical record. We don't simply have to have philosophical debates about whether individualism or a more community-centered collective approach works. We have a history, and we can see definitively that the idea, as you rightly pointed out, of Black citizens engaging in uplift, that led to more violence in part. That led to the feeling that this was unacceptable. So the idea that individual uplift will cure society of racism misunderstands racism as a collective problem and also displaces blame away from the perpetrators of racial inequality onto its victims and those citizens who actually are affected by racism day in and day out. So I think it's so important today to emphasize the importance of collective action and community, and to say that anti-racist struggle is a collective practice.
When you say it's a collective practice, I really do feel that so powerfully. And then, of course, the challenge is getting people who have less invested in the outcome to engage in that collective practice. So after George Floyd was murdered, you couldn't go on social media without seeing his face plastered across every account. It didn't matter what the race of the person posting was. And then a few months later, the people mostly still talking about it were Black and brown people. And most white people had gone back to posting about cooking or, whatever. And I wonder what that says to you, because for me, it's always a bit disheartening. I'm always sort of like, oh, here we go again. I mean, and I like food, so it's not that. But can we keep our eye on the ball as a community? And that feels so challenging.
I totally share that feeling of, optimism and pessimism all at once. And I think there's one or many lessons to be learned, and that is this is a practice that we've seen time and time again. This is not new. And I think that to me is one of the most important things to keep in mind, that when Frederick Douglass was trying to create an organization, to create a organ of collective engagement, he felt incredibly despondent. You can read his letters. He felt a certain level of pessimism. When MLK was trying to mobilize, not for 1 year, not for 2 years, but for 13 years, he felt a sense of doubt, self-criticism, and so on. And I think one of the things that you see throughout history, going back to James Baldwin, who says, and I think I conclude one of the chapters with this, that what's important is not developing a majority, it's developing a minority of engaged citizens. That's the most important thing. And throughout the history of the United States, you see that the way that issues like racism, like the problem of police brutality and mass incarceration become politicized and stay in the fore of public consciousness is through the direct action of those who are committed, is through struggle of those who believe in the importance of raising these issues time and time again. I often talk to my students and they have this romanticized understanding of the 60s that today everyone's on their cell phones, today everyone's on social media, on Instagram. But in the 1960s, everyone was committed. Everyone believed in something. And I think that there's a certain kind of willful pessimism, which allows you to be excused from actually knowing that you have responsibility to do something today. Because if you can romanticize the past and say, it was great then, but now things are different, then that kind of exonerates you from responsibility. And I think one of the things, you know, I like to mention and point out is throughout American history, anti-racism has been a difficult and arduous task. And it has always been enacted, not by the majority, but by the minority. The vast majority of white people in the 1960s thought MLK was dangerous. They did not believe that he was a freedom fighter. And it took the effort, the strenuous effort of all of the courageous activists and folks who didn't even know that they would be activists to keep that in public consciousness. And I think that that's important to remember.
I completely agree. And I really love the way you frame that because it takes it out of the sort of larger, you need the whole world to do this, and puts it into, no, we as individuals need to come together with other like-minded individuals and keep pushing. And honestly, I mean, it's like the rest of life. We have no control over the outcome, but we can definitely move ourselves in the direction we want to go. And that feels to me like what our responsibility is ultimately right now. So it's just to keep moving in the direction we know we need to go. So we're almost out of time. And I would like to ask you to just give the listeners three simple things that they can do to make a positive impact in this effort and to really become civic radicals in the best possible way.
Well, I think one of the things that you mentioned and one of the things that I think is so important is in your conversations, in your engagements with others, try to refrain from tone policing. I think tone policing is, again, it's not simply a really disrespectful and critical behavior. I think there is something so dehumanizing about trying to take away the passion and indignation and rage or joy that comes from being able to articulate a position. And I think there's a certain kind of pattern of tone policing that necessitates, leads to a general disregard for people's experiences. And I think doing away with tone policing would be an important first step. I think another important issue and another kind of important practical thing is to know that when you think about political action, when you think about political activity, it's important to understand the standpoints and perspectives of particular citizens. So I'm a white scholar, and for me to understand anti-racist struggle, I knew I couldn't simply look at John Brown to look at white anti-racists. I knew I had to understand the Black anti-racist struggle and to learn about that struggle through those particular voices. And so I think it's incumbent upon all citizens, specifically white citizens, who want to learn more about how to be allies, how to be committed to anti-racism, to understand the perspective, the standpoint of Black citizens who have to experience it on a daily basis. The third thing I would say is I think there's value to being unapologetic in what you believe in. And this is something I think you've alluded to throughout our conversation, which is rather than trying to constantly create bridges it's important to understand that you have a value network and system within your community. So rather than trying to, and I hear this all the time, obsess over reaching across the aisle, you know, find spaces in your community, find organizations within your community that you care about and are doing good work that is important to you. That's how racial justice historically has been enacted. Abolitionists weren't looking to racists in order to build the Underground Railroad. They were building this network through allies. Martin Luther King was trying to make allies with the women's movement, with the anti-war movement, with various organizations that were committed to social justice. He wasn't trying to appeal to white supremacists like Bull Connor. So I think it's so important to recognize the power within your community and figure out ways to connect with the resources that are already there.
I love that. Thank you. Because one of the things I am always saying to people is start with those to whom you have proximity, you know, start close in and then work your way out, because A, it's the easiest, and B, ultimately, I think it's the most effective means. It's not the fastest, perhaps, but since none of us is going to live to see the end of this anyway, we might as well not focus on speed. Well, I have absolutely loved this conversation. I am so glad that we got to talk, and I'm so grateful for the wisdom in your book and the things I learned. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me as a guest. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you. There are so many issues that are facing us right now, issues that won't be solved by tiptoeing around them. We have to look at our challenges and confront them head on. Pretending that things aren't what they are or not as serious as they are will not get it done. We need to be clear, and we need to use our voices with passion and clarity. A good starting point is to take Alex's suggestions and pick at least one to act on. And as always, remember that change starts with story, so keep sharing yours. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back with another episode of Stepping into Truth very soon.